You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nicole. I'm here. We're live. This is News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. New guests to introduce you to. I'm excited about hearing this tale. Texas physician and author Larry Dossey on the power of premonitions. That's right up our alley, of course, and we're going to find out more about that momentarily. We'll get the break done as we do at the top of the hour and go straight through. Hate those interruptions, you know. Wanted to be all in the flow in a good way, so that's what we do here. If you miss any of the show anytime, newsforthesoul.com, all last decade or so shows all free all the time. Yeah, that's how I roll. Newsforthesoul.com, that's where you go, but not now, because he's here live. Momentarily, we're going to get started.
Yeah, man, we all love to hear the good news, so we all should rush to hear the good news. But we can just find the good news. NSPN. News for the soul at the very best. NSPN. News for the soul at the very best. NSPN. News for the soul at the very best. Yeah, man, just log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Can you hear me? We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We never put none of the negative in there. We never put none of the negative in there. NSTN. News for the soul at the very best. NSTN. News for the soul at the very best. Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time. Come here, good news. Share the good news. And we all feeling good for the good news.
Let's meet our new guest. Just such an interesting story, and it's always, I always love the stories where spirit and science cross over when you get medical professionals and people sort of generally, traditionally in the left brain place, having amazing experiences which cross over into that lesser known, the unknown, the unexplained. And as you know, that's where we live here. So that's what we're going to do, is bring all that together, find out about Larry Dossey's story. And for some reason, I've never talked to this man before. I don't know why. Texas physician and author Larry Dossey on the power of premonition. In his 1989 book, Recovering the Soul, he introduced the concept of non-local mind, mind unconfined to the brain and body, mind spread infinitely through space and time. I think we talked to Greg Braden repeatedly about that concept, didn't we? And his thing is about consciousness and emerging consciousness and powers of premonition, but much more. I think we've got a lot to cover. Dr. Larry Dossey, welcome to News for the Soul.
Nicole, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. It's kind of been a long time coming, apparently.
Yeah, I agree. Why haven't we talked before?
I don't know.
It sounds like we're swimming in the same waters, for sure.
Very much so, very much so. But we are now, that's an important point, and boy, you know, we've got to basically do need Dr. Larry Dossey 101, start at the beginning of your story so we can get to know how we got here today.
Sure. Well, The Power of Premonitions is a book that I tried actually not to write. Early on in my career as an internal medicine physician, I really didn't want to venture into these areas because, as you probably know very well, this is not, fooling around with these ideas is not the very best way to advance your career in medicine. But I didn't have much choice in the matter, as it turned out. The very first year I was in medical practice, I had a series of dreams which were precognitive, which is the term I use for premonitions. And I saw the clinical events of my patients before they actually would happen the next day. This scared me to death. I did not know how to deal with this. It unnerved me. And so I did something that I'm really good at, Nicole. I just practiced denial. I just didn't want to deal with these because I did not know what to do with them. But I knew in a heartbeat that the world just didn't work the way I had been taught. If we could see the future, which I clearly had done. So I just sort of stayed in a state of denial for several months after that initial experience. But then my
How many did you have? How many have
well,
the actual...
A series of three, and some of them were so complex and really almost in camera-like detail, they were so specific.
Yes. You know what? That's what caught my eye about your story, I've got to tell you, just personally, because I've had that myself, those dreams, and it's always 24 hours in advance. And I, you know, journalist mind and left brain mind, I mean, it's, you know, it's like I had to have that direct experience as well so I would know.
Yeah.
Couldn't prove it to anybody else, but I would know, right?
Exactly.
It was always 24 hours in advance. And it's different than a dream. It's like very real.
Well, you know, the vividness of these things is one of the most striking features of them. And actually, as we may talk about a little later on, that's one of the clues that we can use about knowing which premonitions that come in dreams are worthy of paying attention to, those really vivid ones that seem like they're sort of lit up from the inside, as one woman told me. But then, a short time later, my patients discovered that I had an interest in this area because I began to write about it in editorials and books. And my patients began to come to me with their premonitions. One morning, one of my favorite patients, she was really a hotshot lawyer in Dallas, came and said, I know I have ovarian cancer and I need your help instantly. She said, I had a dream last night in which I saw three little white spots on my left ovary. So she said, I know that they're ovarian cancer. We did an exam. It was normal. We did a sonogram. And sure enough, on her left ovary, there were the three little white spots, just as she had dreamt them. The good part of that story is that she got her diagnosis wrong, however. These were just benign ovarian cysts and not cancerous lesions. But then nurses started coming to me with their premonitions as well, and I have to say that I've never met a professional group that was more premonition-prone than nurses. And so it went on and on, and over the years I began to feel very comfortable with this. And then when the science behind premonitions began to come out about 3 or 4 years ago with Elegant, the computer-based test, which shows that people can indeed sense the future, I decided to write a book about this, and it fit in with the previous 10 books that I have written about consciousness and spirituality and health, and so premonitions are real, and I think that it's time we all came out of the closet and put this up as a topic for fit discussion.
Well, you and I can't be the only weirdos out there. I mean, it's got to be normal if you know we're discovering each other. But I got to ask, why are nurses this prominent premonition-inclined group?
Well, you know, in your introduction, you mentioned left and right brain, and I think that nurses simply most nurses still are women, and I think that they struggle less with the intuitive side of life than left brain physicians do. Plus the fact that they spend more time at the bedside than physicians do, they hear stories, patients open up to them, they have their own experiences, and I just simply think there's an openness that nurses possess toward this side of our existence that is sort of educated out of young physicians as they go through university and medical school.
So, and it could also be our conditioning, I guess, just the male gender, the way you're raised versus the way we're raised kind of thing, where they're a little more forgiving, perhaps.
Well, I completely agree. I've been married to a wonderful nurse for 42 years, and Barbara, my wife, is a nurse educator, and goes around the country teaching holistic principles to nurses in the same way that I do with physicians. I thought that, as a matter of fact, that doctors would never open up about this, but I was wrong about that. When the book was finished, I had the opportunity to talk to large groups of doctors around the country at medical schools and continuing medical education courses, and I opened up and shared with them the contents of this book and my own experiences. And then this invariably happened, Nicole. The they would in the Q&A session, they would open up and respond by telling me their stories. I thought I would never see this, but it's an amazing thing. I think that they're sitting basically on tons of stories, which most people would be shocked to hear. I know I was. At a last fall at a Harvard Medical School sponsored conference, I was talking with them about these issues, a group of 100 doctors, and one woman stood right up in the middle of the audience, and she said, "Well, I see numbers. I get numbers in my dreams." She said, "I see the specific laboratory values of my patient's lab tests before I even order the tests." And it went from there. So, you know, one of the effects, I hope, of this book is that it will encourage physicians to be more open and public about what I think is just a treasure trove of experiences that they usually are silent about.
So your work with respect to the medical field has been predominantly with premonitions?
It started out looking at the role of consciousness in a book called Space, Time, and Medicine 20-something years ago. And then the thing that I suppose my name is attached to most firmly is the role of prayer in healing. I wrote a book in 1993 called Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine, which wound up, I'm happy to say, on the New York Times bestseller list. And it really had a huge influence on how these matters are discussed and taught in medical schools. For the first time, I came forward with all the studies, the experiments I could find, looking at the role of prayer and healing, and it was shocking. There were around 150 of them. This was a well-kept secret. No one had ever brought these studies forward before, and it really had a quite wonderful effect on the openness of the medical schools toward this area of prayer and healing intentions in medicine. When that book first came out in 93, there were only three of the nation's 125 medical schools that had any place in the curriculum for looking at the role of spirituality and healing intentions in getting well. And now, as we speak, over 90 of the nation's 125 schools have come on board with actual places in the curriculum that talk about these studies, and actually have made a huge difference in medical education. You know, you can't get a medical degree now without knowing how to take a spiritual history from a patient. I find that most people don't know this.
That's shocking, actually, from the stereotype. Like, I wasn't aware it was that.
I think people need to be aware of this. You may not be able to see the difference in how doctors are educated around these things if you go to an individual doctor who hasn't been clued in about this. But, you know, looking down the line, this is going to make a huge difference in the receptiveness of physicians and the way they interact with patients where spiritual issues are concerned.
It's a door opening that, you know, has been rigidly nailed shut in the past, it would seem.
Oh, it sure has. Actually, for most of the 20th century, we've denied that these things are important. Let me give you a statistic, though, that has really been important in the response of the medical schools toward the role of spirituality. There are scores of tests now, experiments and surveys that show that people who follow some sort of spiritual path in their life, on average, live 7 to 13 years longer than people who do not. And they're healthier in the process. They have a lower incidence of all the major diseases. So following a spiritual path, regardless of what you pick, is promotive of good health and longer life. And it's because of this data that the medical schools have come on board and responded, because I think it's clear to most of them now that we cannot ignore any longer such a huge factor in health and longevity. It would be like turning your eyes away from the role of stopping smoking, which is hugely important for people's health, not to do. So I'm happy to report to you that we're making, I think, landmark progress in this field.
Well, that is excellent news. Specifically with the prayer thing, before we move beyond that stage of your work, mm-hmm. what were your specific findings as far as, like, what was the nature of the prayer? Was it positive expectation, or was it sort of praying to a higher source? What kind of prayer was it?
Well, it's been looked at carefully in several studies by now, and you know, it's almost embarrassing. These prayer strategies are all over the ballpark. People who are affiliated with a specific religion will pray to their version of the Almighty. Some will simply pray, may thy will be done, or may the best thing happen, without attaching a specific outcome request. Other people are more comfortable praying simply for an open-ended kind of thing. Others about a specific outcome, you know, take the cancer away, heal the heart attack, something that specific. But then there are people who pray who are not affiliated with the religion. That seems kind of strange to people in our culture, but Buddhism, for example, is not a theistic religion. Buddhists don't pray to a supreme being. But Buddhist prayer in these experiments is equally effective as fundamentalist Christian prayer. The picture that's come out of all of these experiments in prayer and healing is that no specific religion has cornered the market on prayer and healing.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
I'm happy.
Isn't the one fundamental common denominator with all the things you mentioned, isn't the singular common denominator firm belief?
Yes, that's part of it. You know, I think there may be one, however, that trumps even that, Nicole, and I think that's love. Compassion, caring, deep, deep concern for whoever it is we're praying for. You know, we often say in casual conversation that we pray for our loved ones, and I think there's a whole bunch of meaning in that comment. If people pray unconditionally, out of love and compassion and deep concern, regardless of the religion they're affiliated with, there's statistical evidence that those prayers work. And so I think that says a lot about the role of religious tolerance in our culture, you know, that no specific religion owns prayers of healing, although some fundamentalists seem to think they do.
Yes. But moving on from there, but the bottom line is it's created data that has made its way into the mainstream medical teaching community, which is excellent to hear.
Yeah, it's that pesky little four-letter word, data. Yeah, that's made all the difference.
It does. Well, it's brought those two places together, and that's excellent news. Now, but how, I mean, it's still such a stretch to end up with you standing in, you know, Harvard with all these doctors going, yeah, I've had premonitions too. That's still another big leap. So how did that leap happen between, you know, power of intent or prayer to there?
Yeah, For me, it hasn't been a huge leap. I think there's a big umbrella that encompasses all of the books that I've written, and it has to do with consciousness and how consciousness manifests in the world. I started out talking about non-local mind. I introduced the term in 1989 in a book called Recovering the Soul. And for me, the ability of our intentions to reach out through space and even time to bring about healing in distant people who are in need is just one manifestation of how our consciousness operates in the world across space and time. And I think premonitions are simply another manifestation of that same aspect of our consciousness. Premonitions show that consciousness isn't confined just to the present. We can know events in the future. So for me, this has all been of a piece, looking at how consciousness manifests in the world. I think this is the thread that runs through everything I've ever written, all 11 books.
Yes, no, absolutely. We've talked for you. This is why I was kind of shocked that we haven't talked before. We've covered this for about, you know, 12 years here as well. Remote viewing, the science of distance, space, time, literally doing time sliding targets and all that over the years on Use for the Soul. It's been profoundly life-changing for those of us that have done that and coming from a knowing place. How do you, I mean, let's talk about that first work, since it's our first time talking. I mean, that was quite cutting edge for, you said 1989?
Yes, that's right. My personal experiences with premonitions occurred many years prior to that. And also my experience with remote healing. I live in a part of the world, northern New Mexico, where there's a shaman or a healer behind every tree, almost, it seems. And, you know, it gave me the opportunity, after leaving Dallas and moving here to northern New Mexico, to really jump in and explore what Native American healers thought about the nature of consciousness and prayer strategies and on and on and on. And so coming to northern New Mexico was just really a very fertile thing for me to do in terms of opening up my own perspectives. There proved to be a tremendous reception for my books around the country. Life remains for me an airplane. I have the wonderful opportunity to talk to thousands of doctors every year at medical schools and hospitals around the country about these cutting-edge issues. And I find that most of them are fascinated. Most of them are completely in the dark that there is such a thing as a controlled experiment in healing and controlled experiments and future knowing or premonitions. And so I've just been sort of someone who's an ambassador who runs around the country stirring the pot over these controversial issues. It's a marvelous opportunity that I've been given, and not many people have the opportunity to be asked to talk about these controversial things. But I think most physicians have a real hunger to open up about these things. They've been instructed that the world doesn't work like this, so they've come to doubt their own personal experiences where remote healing and miracle cures and premonitions are concerned. But that is changing. There was a survey, Nicole, about 4 years ago looking at over 1,000 physicians around the country and all subspecialties. And the goal of the survey was to discover doctors' beliefs about spiritual healing. And 75% of them said that they thought that miracles had occurred in the past. An equal number said that miracles still occur in the present. And 55% of them said that they had actually seen what they would call miracle cures in their own patients. So, you know, what's going on here? If the stereotypical picture is that doctors believe none of this. You know, they're hard-headed intellectuals who wouldn't go down that path, you know, of spirituality or remote effects of consciousness and all that. But the surveys show otherwise.
So what are these, the tests, the blind studies on future knowing you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
What are those?
Well, I give you one example of the studies that I find most compelling myself. They've come out of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and about 20 other researchers around the world who have replicated these things. I'll bet you know the name Dr. Dean Radin.
Yes. He's been on the show before.
Yeah. He spearheaded and pioneered these tests, and they're just ingenious. And they show without a doubt in most of our opinions, those of us who look at these things, that we have an innate ability to see the future and that this is extremely widespread in human beings. So what he does is to hook somebody up to a computer, they will have some bodily event measured. It could be the diameter of their pupil, which responds to stress, or it could be their blood pressure or the electrical conductivity of their skin, the sort of thing that's measured in a lie detector test, anything that registers stress and emotion in the body. And so this computer is going to show the individual a picture, and it will be one of two types. It will either be a really serene, peaceful scene, like a scene from nature or at the beach or something like that, or it will be exactly the opposite. It will be a very emotional scene, something extraordinarily violent, like an autopsy or a trauma or something like that, or even erotic, emotionally stimulating images. The computer doesn't know what it's going to do before it does it because it's programmed to make a random choice between these two types of pictures. Here's the thing. If the image that's going to be shown is one of these violent, emotional things, the body begins to react several seconds before the computer ever shows the image or before it even makes the randomized choice. The body doesn't respond nearly as much as if the picture that's coming up is one of these peaceful things. So the question is, how in the world does your unconsciousness and your body pick up on what's going to happen before the computer even does it?
Or does your mind affect what the computer so-called randomly chooses?
Well, it could be that way, but then you get into an equal mystery of how in the world that happens. Most people who look at these things seem to think that information is coming from the future into the present, informing people for what lies ahead in the future before it even takes place. There are a couple of Nobel Prize winners who have actually taken these tests and hooked up to the computer and come away extremely sobered. And I talk about these two individuals in the book on premonitions. And they seem to think that information is coming from the future into the present. But whatever is happening, it shows that our consciousness is not confined to the present and probably not even to the brain. I think, it's, to use that term once again, I think we have a non-local mind not localized to the brain or to the present, but a mind that can reach out in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
One reason I am enthusiastic about talking about this picture of consciousness is that I believe it points like an arrow toward immortality. And the way that works, I think, is that these studies show we have a timeless aspect of who we are. And if you reason through that, it seems like this is an indicator of what we used to call the soul, something that is outside of time, that's eternal, and therefore immortal. So I think you get more out of these experiments than just, a little trick that helps you know what a computer's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are larger lessons here, and they have to do with immortality and our destiny.
It's really about the big questions, isn't it? That's why we're...
Yeah, the big questions, capital B, capital Q. Yeah, that's it.
Absolutely. And, I mean, like you said, with that one example of the blind test, it's astounding. Whatever it is, it's astounding what's going on, and it's very telling that we're more than we've been told we are. And I think you bring up a really good point, too, because this has been my theory for some time, is that even in the stodgiest of mainstream outlets, there's still human individuals just like us within them, and they're all having, it can't just be you and me. And we know it's not you and me,
There's
people there having the same things, and it's going to come out. We're going to figure this out.
I've had the opportunity to travel around the country for 3 months on a book tour for The Power of Premonitions, and talked to thousands of people at bookstores and so on, and I've discovered, Nicole, that everybody's got a story about premonitions, how they've had some intuition or hunch that's saved their life or allowed them to know about a health issue that's coming up or avoid a disaster or something like that. And people are just hungry to tell their stories. So I say that just to affirm what you said, that it's not just you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Surveys show that over half the American population has had at one time or other some sort of premonition, and whether they call it a premonition or a gut feeling or an intuition about what lies ahead. And
So what are some of the most shocking, you know, ones that even got you, made you just go, wow? What are some of the most amazing stories?
Here goes. This was related to me in a bookstore in Seattle several weeks ago. And it concerned the husband of a woman who told me this, who came to the bookstore talk. And her husband was an internal medicine doctor. And one day, a patient came and she said, I've got breast cancer. I dreamed about it last night. And she took an index finger and she pointed and she said, it's right here. The doctor did a breast exam. It was normal. He even did a mammogram just to allay her anxiety. It was completely normal. And so she wouldn't let him off the hook. She said, look, this is the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life. I want a breast biopsy. And so what to do? He finally phoned a friend of his, a doctor who's a surgeon, a breast surgeon, and said, look, you know, would you just do the biopsy? And the doctor said, well, where in the heck am I going to biopsy? There's nothing to biopsy. And the first doctor said, well, just biopsy where she points. So the surgeon agreed to do it, and about a week later, the pathologist who had looked at the tissue under the microscope phoned the first doctor and said, this is the tiniest breast cancer I've ever seen in my career. It's absolutely microscopic. How did you know it was there? It wouldn't have caused any symptoms. You couldn't have felt it. It wouldn't even have shown up on a mammogram. And to his credit, the doctor said, I didn't find it. She did in a dream.
Wow.
So if you think about all of the statistical probabilities there about all the places in two breasts where she could have been biopsied to have found this thing right exactly where she pointed on the basis of a dream, I think is fairly stunning.
Fairly, indeed.
You want to hear one more that made the hair stand up?
Oh, I want to hear tons more.
Well, this one was told to me also by a woman at a bookstore in Seattle. I don't know what it is about Seattle, but, boy, people seem to be premonition prone there. This woman had a feeling that her son was in danger. You know, this just came on out of the clear blue. She was on one side of the country, and her son lived all the way across the United States. And this was an oppressive feeling to her. This was not a dream. This occurred in full waking consciousness. And so all of a sudden she saw a string of numbers just float into her mind. She had no idea what this string of numbers meant. But then she got the notion that she should pick up the phone and dial this string of numbers, which she did. So she was connected with a hospital emergency room in the city where her son lived. The nurse comes on and says, may I help you? And the woman says, I don't know. I don't even know why I dialed you. I didn't know your number. And so she said, I'm just worried about my son. Well, what's his name? And she says it, and this nurse says, oh, yes, he just came in a couple of hours ago. Dr. So-and-so has just finished taking care of him. Let me get the doctor on the phone for you. So the doctor comes on the phone and says, your son was terribly injured, but I'm happy to tell you that he's going to be just fine. So what do you mean?
Wow.
Well, wow.
That's pretty dramatic.
That's what I said. So, you know, one, you think you've heard the strangest premonition story of all, and then somebody else comes along with one that tops that. And,
I like when it becomes, when you've heard it so much, it becomes normal.
Well, I agree. You know, these things used to seem so strange to me. I must say that I've gotten so many of these stories, and people keep emailing me their premonitions, that I've come to believe that this is just the way the world works, and we need to evolve to a willingness to talk about this. And I'd like to think that that's what we're doing. In the same way that prayer and healing have become respectable to talk about in medical schools, I'm hoping that we can see the same evolution toward a greater openness toward talking about premonitions.
I think we in a lot of circles, we are doing that already, vis-a-vis, you know, here for 12 years now, and many places, you know. I think you're right. It's just our natural state, and we've just got to deal with it. Have you had any further premonitions yourself?
I've had some minor ones. Nothing on the order of the shocking, stunning ones that I had the first year I was involved in medical practice. I've often asked myself why that's so. I've had some minor premonitions, I would call them, about minor things. But I think that my premonitions didn't dry up. I used to think that they might have, but I think they've just taken other forms. I think my premonition sense now has evolved into something I just want to call intuition. It's just sort of a hunch or gut feelings, kind of subtle knowing. And, Nicola, I think it serves me pretty well. I think I have a pretty good premonition sense about what lies ahead, and I think it has worked to my advantage in my personal and professional life, and I'm very grateful for it.
Well, it's easy to see the purpose behind the dramatic entrance, you know, so it would get your attention and change your path for what work you're doing on the planet. So it makes sense. It really does. You know, the dream premonitions are a separate category in my mind because I've had these, and I know it's really weird. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like even just a sudden vision or something. It's I hate using the word dream because it's more like a dramatic communication in an altered state that right. happens to wake you up in your sleep or something, you know?
Well, I feel the same way. You know, this thing that you mentioned earlier about the vividness of them seems to set them apart from just routine fantasy-type dreams that we forget, you know, almost as quickly as they happen. One woman told me that these premonitions that turn out to be true seem absolutely different from her normal dreams. She said they come to her in italics, as if they're set apart in some way. One woman said that they feel like they're realer than real, and someone else said that they feel like they're lit up from the inside. In other words, they have a special quality that when they're going on, people know that, you know, this is a clue to listen up.
It is, yeah. It's so that you know, exactly. And that's why the word dream just...
doesn't capture it, does it?
Yeah. No, it's deceptive, and it also, because we can put other meaning to it, it really doesn't honor what it is. I've just always been sort of frustrated with, it was like a dream, but it wasn't a dream, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to kind of find terminology around something that we hadn't really defined yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting that we're all saying the same thing. Like, my premonition dream was always about something really important, really dramatic, always within the next 24 hours, and I could never forget any of them, even if I wanted to.
Yeah. May I share one more with you that
capture,
I think, some of the qualities that people ought to pay attention to? One of these qualities is the mother-child relationship. I'll bet you there are more premonitions about a child who is in danger than probably any other single type. I mean, these are just absolutely classic. And I think they show also the importance of emotional bonding in a lot of premonitions. In any case, this is a premonition I opened the book with. It had to do with a young woman, a young mother from Washington State. And she dreamt one night, this is more like a nightmare than anything else, that the chandelier in the ceiling of her infant's room next to her and her husband's bedroom, the chandelier fell out of the ceiling and crushed the child and demolished the crib. And in the dream, she saw a clock on the baby's bureau, which read 4:35 in the morning. So she wakes up. She's absolutely horrified by this dream. It was so vivid. She wakes her husband up and tells him about it, and he just says, it's just a dream. Go back to sleep, which he promptly did. She can't go back to sleep, so she goes and gets the baby out of the crib and brings the baby back to bed with them. So they all go back to sleep, and about a couple of hours later, there's this huge crash from the next room, and she goes in with her husband, and sure enough, the chandelier has fallen from the ceiling and has absolutely wrecked the infant's crib. If the infant had been in the crib, the infant would have been killed. So she looks at the clock in the room, and it says 4:35.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
So this woman...
Wow, I had chills on that one.
Yeah,
wow.
I know. She dreamt
wow.
completely accurately and also down to the minute. So, again, I would just emphasize that this issue of mother-child bonding and deep emotional connections is a quality that we see quite often in so many premonitions.
You know, I've got to share one of mine with my child with you. It's one that wasn't from any sort of dramatic danger thing, you know, I've had so many of those. I've just never questioned. I always listen to it now.
Yep.
So whenever that kind of event happens, I just unquestionably, you know, whether it makes sense or I have a left brain explanation or not, who cares, right?
Yeah, right.
Listen. And I had the strangest thing when I was pregnant with my youngest daughter where, again, it was during sleep time, but it was not a dream. It literally woke me up, but I was like paralyzed and it was dark, so there's no visual, but it was a communication kind of a thing. And so I sensed a presence, woke up, and I'm lying there in the dark. Like, I don't think my eyes were actually open or anything. And I sensed this presence going, "Hi there. I'm going to be your daughter, or I'm going to be your baby. I'm going to be a girl, and I want you to name me Brianda, please." And it made me sound it out, like, really exaggerated, it, you know, with my mouth, like, "Brianda, Brianda," over and over until I fell asleep. And I woke up the next morning, I thought, what the hell was that? And I went down to, you know, I was going to write it down and keep track in case I actually had a girl, which I did, obviously. And thought, well, I don't know how to spell Brianda. I've never heard that name before. So I went on to, you know, Googling it and looking up baby books, you know, 8 billion names for your baby. Didn't exist anywhere. There was Brianna, and that was it.
Wow.
So I had to make up the spelling, but I thought, hey, cool, she named herself. That was fairly handy and impressive.
Wow, that's a beautiful premonition.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
So there you go. It doesn't always have to be some, you know, life-terrifying moment, but, you know, it's interesting how many stories you've been able to... How many stories have you heard thus far, do you think?
Oh, gosh, hundreds. I think I've got enough for another a sequel to the first book.
I was going to say, yeah, this you could probably just keep going.
You know, so many of them, warn people of impending health crises and just physical illnesses or even physical disasters, hurricanes or tsunamis or something of that sort, or crashed airplanes or trains or something.
Yes.
That people avoid them by taking action. And I've come to regard premonitions as a kind of preventive medicine, because they often give people a heads up about things to avoid. Along those lines,
do you find that people always take action? I mean,
no.
I've been in that situation, you know, where I thought, oh, God, if I say something, they're going to think I'm insane, but if I don't say something and then it happens, I'm going to really regret it forever. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I've had situations where I've had to say, look, if you do that, you're going to die. So
yeah.
Have you had a lot of people with stories like that?
Yes, I have, actually. One of the most dramatic I came across was a story of a man who worked in the bottom floor of one of the Twin Towers on 9/11. And several days before 9/11, he had a dream that the towers were falling down, people were jumping out of buildings, the whole world was sort of in chaos. And then, unknown to him, his wife began to report that she had an identical dream. He did not tell her about his dream, so he did not cue her. So he had this husband and wife who had the identical dream that the towers were going to crash. They were both really intellectual people, and they chose to disregard the dream. And unfortunately, he died at the work site in one of the towers on 9/11. This is an example of a shared premonition, and I'll tell you, if that ever happens to listeners, if you know your spouse or your partner begins to share a dream that you don't cue them on about something terrible coming up, that is a sure sign to pay attention and take something really seriously if the dream is shared, the premonition is shared.
Wow.
Before we leaving 9/11, I might mention one thing that I think is very important evidence, perhaps, about taking premonition seriously. Most people tend to think that those four doomed airplanes on 9/11 were packed full of people, and you know, four full planes crashed that day. But that wasn't the case. They were 79% empty.
Yeah.
And that's not just one of those planes. It was all four of them.
I know. It's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is shocking.
I was specifically going to say, as soon as you mentioned 9/11, you know, you must have a lot of stories just on, I mean, that could be probably several books full of premonition stories alone.
Well, if you Google premonitions of 9/11, you'll come up with 500,000 hits.
Yeah.
I spent days looking. A lot of these things are on YouTube, where people are so impressed they made a video describing these things. And I spent days looking at these things. And some of them are absolutely eerie. They were so camera-like in detail. But it seems like a lot of people have found some reason not to travel on 9/11, with those planes being 79% empty. I don't know about you, but I fly a lot, and I don't get on airplanes that are only 21% full.
Especially now. Oh, my goodness, no. Well, you know, this is the thing, though, is bringing this out into the fore like you're doing. People, you know, you still don't know when you've had those, oh, should I say something or should I take a different action? Or, you know, we still have that programmed instinctive response to doubt. And I think that's the most important thing you're doing is, you know, educating people to listen and tune in and listen when something is speaking to you in that manner.
Well, I hope that that's the result of this book. You know, we might remind people about the clues that one can find in order to tell the ones apart from that they should pay attention to, rather than sort of fantasies. And we keep mentioning the vividness. That's certainly one. And we've mentioned if they're shared by a partner or a spouse, you know, that's a clue to listen up. And also if they're recurrent. I use examples in the book of illness dreams, impending illness type dreams that just wouldn't go away. And then when the person went to the doctor and related this, tests actually prove that these recurrent premonitions were right on target. These are very, very frequent. Carl Jung also said that if you have a premonition of death, that it should always be taken seriously because you might not get a second chance. So vividness, recurrence, whether or not they're shared and whether they deal with death, are clues that people could use to differentiate serious premonitions from those that can be just disregarded.
Do you find the 24-hour factor, is that common?
Yeah, most of these do happen within 24 hours. Actually, there's one woman I talked about in the book who really is a quite famous woman in England who has these dreams all the time. Hers are invariably 21 days. This is called the precognitive interval, the interval between the premonition and its eventual happening. I have no idea, Nicole, why some people's premonition interval is one day, and other people it's 3 weeks. You know, hers is always 3 weeks, 21 days. I do not understand that at all.
Yeah, and mine's always 24 hours, like without fail. And, you know, the other thing, too, like you mentioned the vividness, that I'd even go one further than that and say it's like you're really there as opposed to dreamlike really at all.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, you know, one way to get a handle on the quality of these things and therefore know which ones possibly to pay more closer attention to is to keep a dream diary. People who really get good at this business often write down their dreams immediately on awakening. And this helps them keep track of the ones that come true and tell them apart from those that don't, and therefore they can develop a sensitivity to the ones that are more likely to actually pan out. Also, one way of increasing people's sensitivity to premonitions is to develop a meditation practice. If you look at people who are really good with this business, almost always they will have some discipline in their life where they learn to sit down, be quiet, and pay attention. Whether people call that premonition or contemplation or just getting quiet, that's really one of the best ways that has ever been discovered to become more premonition prone.
Wow, this hour has just gone ridiculously fast. I could talk to you forever. Let's give out your website before we run out of time here. What is your website?
Yeah, it's easy. It's DossieDossie.com. It's Dossie twice. I share it with my wife. That's why there are two Dossies there. And that's spelled D-O-S-S-E-Y.
Wonderful. Well, I hope it's not another 12 years before we get to talk again. I'd love to share more stories and stay in the Dossie-Dossie loop.
Let's make a point to make that happen.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Nicole.
Dr. Larry Dossie, you can find him at DossieDossie.com. That is so cute. DossieDossie.com. And, yes, it will get him on again. And, you know, I'd love to hear your stories if you can relate to what we've been talking about today. I'm sure many of you can. News@newsforthesoul.com is our email, and newsforthesoul.com. If you missed any of this show or any of our shows ever, that's where you go. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you again, I hope, real soon.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Call in to live News for the Soul shows daily for intuitive coaching, readings, numerology, leading-edge health information, and much, much more with featured hosts from around the world. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our heart and open up our souls, and let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
From the heart of Vancouver, what a great place to bring News for the Soul.
I know, isn't it perfect? Remember that movie Dead Zone, Christopher Walken?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like that for real.
I think reasonably accurate, too, honey.
Oh, that's an understatement, honey. The Great Experiment. Welcome to News for the Soul, James Twyman.
Yes, this is Uri.
Hi, Uri. It's Nicole Whitney calling News for the Soul. Welcome to News for the Soul, Robert Allen.
Thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here with you tonight.
Why are you here? We're talking to Carolyn Mace about Sacred Contracts, one of her many best-selling books. Welcome to the show, Greg Braden.
Well, good evening, Nicole. It's certainly a pleasure to hear your voice and a pleasure to be here tonight.
Welcome to the show, Stuart Wild.
Thank you very much.
John Kehoe, welcome to News for the Soul.
Hey, how are you?
Next up, Dr. David Morehouse.
I'm so glad that you called me because you are doing such an important task, important work, because you are spreading a very positive message. And my message to everyone who is listening is be positive, be optimistic, but most important, believe in yourself. And then good things will start coming your way.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
So
I love you all.
So that was Uri Geller, who spoke to him in his home near London, England.
I was really moved by last week's show because we made a commitment to a worldwide event to try to change consciousness.
And we love News
for the soul.
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show. Just enormous, enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing, amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing. Like, this is what's getting, it's some angel telling somebody, hey, listen, get on this show, listen to this program. If not my program, whatever program you've got on. It's really amazing.
It's hard to believe it's 17 years since I was there in Vancouver. And you were sitting there in class and you were using remote viewing. And I think I said to you that you were going to be a radio talk show host or something along those lines. It wasn't really a prediction. It was just a kind of a sense of who you were and what you were doing and the direction you were going. And wow, voila. And there you were.
And still going.
But it's amazing. Look at what you've done with it. I just wanted to say I'm very proud of you for what you've accomplished, for just the format, to the assemblage of wonderful people, great minds, and people who are working to serve humanity and do the things that they do. I've been looking through your list of callers and interviewees, and you just do a tremendous job. I'm so proud of you. I really am. And I'm proud of all the people that support you and follow you and do what they do, and just keep doing that for this wonderful woman. It's so important because there are not a lot of really high-quality message portals that are out there where messengers get to come in and say what they want to say in this format. So it's because of your support of her that she's able to continue doing that. So please step that up and continue doing it. And I just want to do it more. I mean, I feel good being here and being with you. I always do when I'm talking with you. So I think we just need to keep doing this more.
And we love News for the South!
Hello, everybody. This is Daniel Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Informers. This is News for the Soul.
Hello, this is Satyan Raja, and you're listening to News for the Soul. Be open in your mind, your body, your being. Allow yourself to drench in this awesome information to evolve you to your next place.
Hey, this is Dave Morehouse, and you're listening to News for the Soul.
Call in to live News for the Soul shows daily for intuitive coaching, readings, numerology, leading-edge health information, and much, much more with featured hosts from around the world. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Yay, we are live April 11th, 2017. It is 10 a.m. Pacific, 11 Mountain Time, I do believe, and that's the time we had pegged away for a very special hour on News for the Soul, especially in times that we are in right now. We've talked to him many times over the years, and this, I believe, is going to be one of the most important chats because of what's going on in our world today. Greg Braden, New York Times best-selling author, internationally known as a pioneer in bridging science and spirit, which is one of the favorite places we like to hang out. Following a successful career as a computer geologist in the 1970s, he worked as a senior liaison with the U.S. Air Force Space Command during the Cold War years in the 80s. In the 90s, he became started exploring the spirituality side as well, and the two come together in a very most interesting way. He explored high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts, and started connecting the dots, and that's where it gets really exciting. Today, we're going to talk about his latest book as well, Resilience of the Heart. I understand it's the revised edition of The Turning Point, so we're going to find out all about that and find out, well, I'm most excited about checking in and tuning in with Greg's exciting perspective, conscious perspective on what the heck is going on in our world of extremes right now. Greg Braden, welcome back to News for the Soul.
Hey, Nicole, it's so good to hear your voice. I'm absolutely thrilled to be with you today and thrilled to be with our audience. Thank you for inviting me back. We've done this a number of times, and when I saw the list came into my office of my media interviews that I was going to have this week, I saw your name, a big smile on my face because we always have a really great program, and I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Right back at you. We are very much appreciating the piece that you bring to the big picture, and holy moly. I don't even know where to start today. It's been a few years since we've talked, but
you know,
can I start?
Can I get us started today?
Yes.
I'm going to just share with our listeners. I had a really interesting interview recently, another radio station, and the first thing the interviewer said to me, he didn't say "Welcome to the show," "How are you," anything like that. He said, "Greg, why can't you stick with one topic like everybody else?" He said, "You are all over the map." He said, "Are you talking about science, spirituality, about DNA, about ancient history, about earth magnetics, about climate change?" He goes, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "You know, every one of those things that you've just mentioned is a facet of the human experience. And in a very real sense," I said, "I am talking about one thing, one topic. It just happens to be a really big topic, and it's about us and our relationship to ourselves and to the world and to the past and one another and to the future." And then he said, "Well, let's take a station break." And then we came back and did the rest of the interview. So my work, it does touch on many facets of our experience because we don't live in a vacuum. That's the world that we live in. And that's one of the reasons I love working with you, Nicole, because you are doing such a beautiful job of taking a message that for some people is a new way and a very different way of thinking and sharing this in a responsible way across the airwaves. And I appreciate that, just appreciate it tremendously.
Well, we really value your work and your piece, and I'm extremely interested to get your overall perspective. That's where I'd like to start is, if the world's very different than it was when we last talked. We were kind of on this exciting ascension of connection, and you were showing videos of tumors disappearing in 60 seconds. We're all very happy and excited and woo. And we thought we'd be in a different place by now. It's got this overall view of things kind of going off the rails in the mainstream, and I thought we were further ahead, evolved consciously, and perspective on where we are in the world within the spirit and consciousness connections. How would you sum it up in that view?
Yeah, I was just reading a history summary of the last 200 years of our experience, and what many historians now are suggesting, they embrace that the 20th century, they're saying, was a century of what they're calling a century of discovery. Okay, so the big discoveries of physics, classical physics, quantum physics, subatomic particles, DNA, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi Library, the oldest records of the New Testament, the Nag Hammadi, and space exploration. It was a century of exploration, and it revealed many things to us. And the 21st century, they say, where we are right now, is we are on a very steep learning curve of discovering where those discoveries fit in our lives. How do we apply what we now know to be true in our everyday lives? And I think the world is reflecting that right now, Nicole. I trust in the process. The world is a different place than I expected that we would be in, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the indigenous people that I've talked to and worked with, many of the ancient texts, they say within the first 25 years of this new century, they said, we won't even recognize our lives and our world anymore. And I think, we're seeing that happen. So we're learning about ourselves and our relationship to the world based upon new discoveries. And this is what I'm writing about. The new book, the newest book that is on the market right now that you have access to is called Resilience from the Heart. There's actually another book that will be released October of this year called, the title is Human by Design. And both of these books are based upon peer-reviewed science. So it's rock-solid science, not necessarily my opinion or my perspective or my hypotheses or my theories, but this is the new science, Nicole, that is changing the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world. On the one hand, and on the other hand, there is not only a reluctance, but there is a resistance to sharing a lot of this new information in the mainstream because it overturns 150 years of scientific thinking and the story that we tell ourselves. We are steeped in this scientific story that's based upon separation, scarcity, competition, and conflict. And the new discoveries are telling us that we live in a world of cooperation. Nature is based upon cooperation, not competition, and that we are deeply connected to ourselves and one another. And the science is showing us just how deep these connections go. So that is the theme for both of the new books, and the one that you just mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, is just that. It is about the new discoveries of specialized cells in the human heart that allow us a direct access to our bodies in ways that we've never thought possible in the past. We thought only mystics and yogis and special adepts could do something like this, and now it's becoming available to everyday people. So that's a long answer to a short question. I trust in the process and the world, and what I think we're seeing is an unfolding of understandings of what is sustainable or what's not, what works, what doesn't. And what we're finding is a lot of the way we've been taught to think is no longer sustainable. And so we're the generation that's bridging these new discoveries and learning to apply them in our world. And I can't think of a more exciting time to be alive. I'm sure many of your other speakers are probably saying something very similar. So again, that's a long answer to a short question, and I'll follow your lead, and we can go anywhere we want to go from there.
It is a very exciting time for sure. And I think you nailed it right in the first half of your first sentence in response was that, you know, before we were learning about these things, now it's essentially, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but it basically we have to start doing what we've learned.
Yeah.
Start
yeah.
being it.
Well, you know, that's the thing. What's happening is in the mid-1800s, you know, when I began talking about the discoveries of Charles Darwin and, you know, many of the physicists that were making discoveries in the late 1800s, people say to me, Greg, we're in the 21st century. What difference could those things possibly make? And it's a really good question, and the answer surprises a lot of people. Yes, we are in the early 21st century, a sophisticated, highly technological world, and the society that we find ourselves in and the way we have been conditioned to think about jobs, about industry, about our relationship to the earth, about personal relationships, the economy, corporations, all of those things, those ideas, those foundations were created in the mid to late 1800s. So we are steeped in a story based upon the science of the late 1800s, and now the new science is overturning many of those beliefs. So knowing that we live in a world of cooperation, for example, rather than competition, that nature is actually based in cooperation. Our economic systems were based upon competition and conflict based on the science of the 1800s, and that's why the economies of the world are in chaos right now. We're seeing the Brexit in the Middle East. We're seeing the European Union face a possible breakdown. We're looking at the kind of debt. Here's a question, Nicole. This is fascinating. We've all seen nations in debt in the past, and it's common for another nation or a group of nations to bail them out. What happens when the debt of the entire planet is greater than what the entire planet is producing? When the GDP of the entire planet is less than the debt that we've accumulated, who bails out an entire planet? And I don't know the answer to that. We're about to find out because that's where we are right now. The industrialized nations have accrued so much debt that can never be paid back. That affects everything from, you know, the way that we save for retirement, the way we save for our kids' education, our health care, all of those things. So they're breaking down because they are based on principles that are simply not true. We don't live in a world of competition and conflict. We see those things. I mean, we have to be real, though we definitely witness competition and conflict in the world. And what the scientists now are telling us is the more of that competition and conflict that we see in the world, the further we have strayed from the natural laws and the more difficult it is for us to find our balance. So for me personally, I'm a scientist. I was trained as an earth scientist, a geologist. And I know some of your other guests and dear friends of mine, Dr. Bruce Lipton, for example, and Dr. Joe Dispenza, we all look to nature for the model of helping us to understand our relationship to ourselves and to the world and how to build a healthy family and a healthy community and healthy societies. So if we look to nature, nature is showing us a very different model than what we have in place right now. And we're seeing, I think, the world is going through the throes of the changes to try to get back to more of those natural states of balance. And that's what the book, Resilience from the Heart, is all about. Because one of the discoveries, and we mentioned this briefly in another interview, one of the discoveries that has just rocked the world of the medical world, the world of biology, is the discovery of 40,000 specialized cells in the human heart that were simply not recognized in the capacity that they are right now. They are called sensory neurites. And that's a technical term. They're essentially brain-like cells, but they're not in the brain. They're in the heart. So these are the kind of cells you would expect to see in the cranial brain, but they're in the heart. And the reason this is important is because these cells think independently of the cells in our brain. They feel independently of the cells in our brain, and they remember independently of the cells in our brain. So every experience we've had in our lives, essentially it's recorded in two places. It's recorded in our brain and the way our brain interprets it, and we know about that. That's recorded in our heart and the way our heart interprets these experiences through these 40,000 cells that have created a neural network that is literally called the little brain in the heart is the term that's being used now. So as now that we know these cells exist, as we're learning to access them, they open the door to extraordinary abilities that I personally believe are actually ordinary abilities that we've either lost or forgotten. And when we can embrace these abilities in our lives, it helps us to embrace change in the world in a healthy way. So if we ever needed a time, or if we never needed some help in embracing the tremendous change happening in the world, now I think is the time to do that, because we are undergoing such a radical shift in the world that we've known in the past. So this is the theme. The new book, in the very first chapter, you asked about the two books. There was a book that was released, I think it was 2015 or 2014. It was called The Turning Point, and it was a good book. It put many of the personal applications and the direct experience and the exercises that help people in their lives, they were in the back of the book. And one of the things that I've learned, Nicole, I'm a student of learning to listen. I'm still learning, and I work very diligently in listening to my audience and to our global audience. And what people all over the world said, they said, we want to get to that stuff faster. We want to get to the stuff that's going to help us in our everyday lives, direct experience, techniques, tools, applications. So I moved all of that to the front, and I added the new material and the new discoveries that simply were not available when I had written the book 2 years previous. So it's new material covering these 40,000 neurites, how we access them, and what it means in a changing world. And that was what sets those two books apart from one another. Does that make sense if I say it that way?
It's so interesting. Decades ago, I interviewed Joseph Chilton Pierce, you know, cracking the cosmic egg. And he was saying all along, you know, for years and years and years, that the real brain power was in the heart. And we've heard so many people refer to that. So when was this recent study you're referring to, when was that published?
Well, first, I've had the honor of knowing, touring, and presenting with Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he was working very closely with the Institute of Heart Math, H-E-A-R-T, capital M-A-T-H, all one word. This is the pioneering research organization based in Northern California that explores the power of the human heart in unconventional ways, in ways that typically aren't done in the universities and in the medical schools, but based in science, in peer-reviewed science. So I had the opportunity of touring with Joseph Chilton Pierce during the years when a lot of this information is being developed. The discovery was made in 1991. It wasn't published until 1994. And even though, this is fascinating for me, even though it was published in 94 and it is now documented, it's peer-reviewed science is documented, it is still not being taught in major medical institutions. And I just came last weekend. I just came from a large conference, and it's very common for us to have medical professionals and healing professionals and scientists and engineers in the audience, along with, you know, with everyone else, the spiritual seekers. They all come together because this material touches on so many different facets of our experience. And I had medical students in the audience, and they were saying, why don't we know about this? Why isn't this being taught in medical school? And I said, you know, I can't answer that question. But you're here now, and now you know about it. So, but it changes. It changes everything. When we talk about this little brain in the heart, and people say, well, you know, is it really a brain? It is it's a collection of cells that are concentrated into a network, a neural network, smaller but very similar to what we see in the brain. And we've learned to use the brain independently. We know that. Now we know that we can use the heart independently. And we also know now that we can harmonize. We can literally tune the heart and the brain together. So two separate organs, but there is one very potent neural network to give us access to extraordinary experiences like deep intuition on demand when we choose to have it rather than spontaneously, you know, when it just happens to occur. It gives us direct access to the subconscious. It's a hotline to the subconscious without hypnosis and without, you know, listening to a special tape. Or, I mean, you can do all those things, but sometimes they're not available. So direct access to the subconscious, and this is important for people who are using affirmations, because an affirmation of healing or health or relationship or career success or self-esteem or abundance or any of those kinds of things, they can only be effective when we are communicating with the subconscious. And if we simply say these things in our mind, but we're not accessing our subconscious, they may not have the effect that we hope that they have. So this harmonizing of the heart and the brain is a hotline into the subconscious to make those kinds of things more effective. Harmonizing the heart and the brain is a trigger for a extra powerful, super immune response. And I can speak for my colleagues, my dear spiritual brothers and friends that I've toured with, such as Bruce Lipton and Joe Dispenza. We use these tools, or we couldn't tour the world with the kinds of schedules we have if we didn't have really powerful immune systems and the ability to regulate these things. So we apply these in our own lives. It's also a trigger for the anti-aging hormones that every one of us has in our bodies. It's also a trigger for reducing stress and creating more resilience in our lives in time of change. So all of a sudden, knowing that we have access to these cells and that we can harmonize our heart and the brain and our brain together so they can work together, the act of doing this, that single act, opens the door to this vast array of applications, whether it's intuition on demand or, you know, the 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions. And we can do this. This is what makes us so very powerful. We now know that we are the only species known so far that can trigger these and initiate these relationships on demand. Other forms of life may be able to do it naturally, but we can consciously say in this moment in time, I choose to initiate a state of deep intuition. And that covers everything from precognition, you know, knowing about something before it's going to happen, to being able to communicate with other forms of life, with other mammals. A lot of research is being done with using the heart to communicate with other forms of life. It just goes on and on. So I'm sharing, we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg here. This opens an entire new door of possibilities for these experiences that help us in everyday life that we in the past believed were relegated only to mystics and yogis, you know, living isolated lives in a mountaintop half a world away. We can do this stuff in our living room. And the science now is telling us how it works. And our most cherished and ancient spiritual traditions are telling us how to apply these things in our lives. This is where these two come together in a really beautiful way.
How do we access and utilize these brain cells in the heart? And have you actually engaged in any of these experiments with anyone around that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll say the instructions I give, they're very detailed instructions that are in the book Resilience from the Heart. The science has been validated. A lot of the science comes from the Institute of Heart Math and the work they've done over the last 20, I'm sure it's more than 20 years now, that they have perfected in the laboratory under laboratory conditions. My experience with indigenous people is that they have initiated techniques that parallel what the science is now developing. And I think if something is true, I think you're going to see it show up in a lot of different ways. So the fact that science is now catching up, science is only about 300 years old. These indigenous traditions, spiritual traditions, many of them are 5,000 years old. So science is catching up with what our ancestors and what many indigenous traditions have always told us. So since 1986, I've had the opportunity to be with our indigenous family in many different settings, and the monks and nuns and the abbots and the monasteries in Tibet and Nepal and India and through the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru and the monasteries in Egypt and all through the American Desert Southwest and the Yucatan and Mexico and more. And as different as they are from one another, Nicole, what's so fascinating is that there are common themes that flow through every one of these traditions, even though they're spread through different times, different environments, different parts of the world. And when I'm working with the healers and the curanderos and the shamans in these traditions, one of the first things they do before they begin whatever their practice is they begin to access their heart. And that's precisely where the science is leading right now. So the techniques are techniques of focus, of breathing, physically being able to draw the attention from our mind into our heart. This is, I think, probably one of the hardest things for people in the West to do. If I ask someone in a Western environment, in a corporate environment, and if I ask them, if I invite them to shift their awareness from their mind into their heart, they'll say, okay, I'm in my heart now, what's next? And I'll say, well, you know, are you really in your heart? And they say, you know, well, how do you know? And this is where these techniques from the indigenous people really come in handy. One, for example, and I'll just share one of the techniques that they share, is if we can gently touch our heart center, the center of our chest, right there on the sternum, gently touch that in a way that's comfortable for us. Some people use their middle finger and their ring finger, and they just simply touch their right on the bone right there, right over the heart. I'm doing it right now as if you could see me, and here we are on the radio, so we're not. But some people in some traditions in the Middle East, for example, they use an entire open palm, and they place that palm over the center of their chest, over their hearts. And they do the same thing in the Yucatan in southern Mexico. They do the same thing. The point here is that the Buddhists will make the prayer mudra that we're all familiar with, and then they hold that prayer mudra with their thumbs right against the center of their chest. And this is what all of these traditions are doing, is they are physically touching their heart center, and here is the reason why that's important.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Our awareness, our conscious awareness, will always go to the place in our body where we feel a physical sensation. So when we physically touch our heart center in one of these ways, our awareness automatically goes to the place where that sensation is, and that is one of the techniques that the indigenous people use to move their awareness from their thinking mind into their feeling heart. So I'm just using that as an example. And then the breathing techniques that come after that are now validated, we have equipment, technology that we can hook people up to specialized pieces of software and be able to actually see the effect in their bodies that are occurring from making these connections. So we can talk more about that if you'd like to. I don't know how far you want to go with all of this.
Down the rabbit hole. Yeah, absolutely. This is news to us all. I'll just remind people listening, if you missed it, you mentioned heart math. I talked to Howard Martin, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and that's in the archives at newsforthesoul.com. And it's funny, you know, when you hear things in threes, this independently, this general topic about the power, true power of the heart, has come up three times independently in three different ways for me this week. So I know this is important, and ultimately tying it back into current world events would be awesome. But tell us what's next.
What's next where?
At where you wanted to go.
Oh, well, you just mentioned Howard Martin. Howard is I met Howard because of HeartMath in the early 1990s, and I trained directly with Howard Martin, who is one of the founders of the Institute of HeartMath. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to tour the world. We have been on stages everywhere, and now I can call him a dear friend as well. So many of the things that I am saying here from my perspective, Howard and the Institute of HeartMath have given me permission as an independent author to share my experience and my perspective, integrating their work at the same time. So where I've had more experience with indigenous people and how indigenous people throughout the different traditions, how they have learned to apply this in our lives, Howard and the research team, the rock-solid science behind this stuff, from their institute in Northern California, they come at it from a little bit different perspective when they're training, you know, in a corporate environment or with the U.S. military or something like that. But the bottom line for both is that we're getting people into their hearts. And that means different things to different people, Nicole. We were conditioned, if we were educated in the West, and I'm assuming most of our listeners may not be in North America, but have a Western education. We've been taught that the brain is the master organ of the body. And we all know the brain is important, of course. It regulates hormones. It regulates, the temperature in our body and a lot of the rhythms and the cycles and the functions within our bodies. But what we now know is the brain receives the instructions that tell it what to do. Many of those instructions come directly from the heart. Every moment of every day, there is this conversation between our heart and our brain. It's happening right now for everyone listening. There's a conversation. I'll just speak directly to our listeners. Listeners, there's a conversation happening right now between your heart and your brain. Your heart is having a big conversation with your brain through the vagus nerve. It's sending a lot of information through this thick nerve bundle into your brain. Your brain speaks to the heart less. It's not as big of a conversation, and it's coming primarily through the spinal column, down through the back of the brain and then down through the nerves in the spinal cord. So we're always having this conversation. The question is, do we know what we're saying? Do we know what it is that our heart is saying to our brain? And that is the core of these new discoveries and the ancient traditions. And it's by learning to focus in our heart, to breathe specific ways, and to feel very specific kinds of feelings that we set up a dialogue. And the dialogue can be measured electrically. It's a very low frequency, 0.1 hertz, not even one, 0.1 hertz is the frequency that's optimum between the heart and the brain. So when we can focus on our hearts, breathe a little slower than usual, signaling safety to our bodies by breathing a little bit slower than usual, and we can begin feeling positive, what I would call, I don't like to judge feelings, but it's what we call positive feelings, such as gratitude, appreciation, care, compassion. Those are four big ones that the scientists have found work for most people almost 100% of the time. So if you can choose one of those, gratitude, appreciation, care, or compassion, this combination of events, the breathing, the focus, and the feeling, and this is key, when we can feel one or some combination of those four feelings, our body interprets that as this electrical signal from the heart to the brain. And the optimum signal is 0.1 hertz. And when we can establish 0.1 hertz, we can feel the feelings of 0.1 hertz between our heart and our brain, we are said to be in high heart-brain coherence. And that heart-brain coherence is the key to everything that we're talking about here. So in the new book that you mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, first chapter we talk about the new discovery, the cells, 40,000 specialized cells, and then throughout the book, what this means and how we apply it in our lives through various exercises. So that's the essence of what that book is all about.
So are feelings the key, the doorway?
You know, it's interesting. They are not exclusively the key. They are an important component that's been discounted in our culture. For most, most people, we have feelings and emotions and experiences, and we've been conditioned to discount them to a large extent until recently. People in their 50s and 60s right now remember when we were taught that, you know, your feelings aren't, they're not really real. I mean, it's just a feeling is what they used to tell us. You know, it was discounted. Now we know that the feeling is a powerful component in these indigenous traditions. And interestingly, Nicole, the very texts of our most cherished spiritual traditions, the Western Bible, for example, and some of the Eastern traditions, when they were edited and there were pieces that were removed or condensed, what was taken out was the information that tells us the power of human emotion. So, for example, in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the New Testament, and this isn't about religion, this is about instructions. This is about the masters of the past informing their students of the deep relationship that their students had within themselves and with the world around them. And those were based upon spiritual principles. The religions came along later and wrapped the rules and the dogma around those fundamental spiritual principles for control. But before the religions ever existed, those principles were already there, and so that's why I'm mentioning this. So, for example, New Testament, we know at least 43 books were removed in the 4th century by the Emperor Constantine. And what we see today is the reduced, rearranged, condensed version. It's good, but it isn't complete. And we know that because the Nag Hammadi Library, discovered in the mid-1940s, revealed for the first time the original well, all the text in their original form. And among those was a book called The Gospel of Thomas. So the Gospel of Thomas contains very specific instructions for the kinds of things that we're talking about that were simply removed from the biblical canon, from the modern Bible in the 4th century, telling us about the power of human emotion and how to use that emotion, you know, for healing in our lives. So that's one example of where we've known this in the past, and then for a number of reasons, that knowledge was taken from one of our most cherished spiritual traditions, and now it's being reintroduced from the language of science. So the power of human emotion is what establishes that 0.1 hertz relationship between the heart and the brain. You can be in your heart and not have the heart-brain relationship, and that is another technique. Sometimes we don't need that full heart-brain relationship. Sometimes we can simply focus in our hearts through touching our heart center, the way that I mentioned, and through breathing techniques that slow our breathing so that we know that we're in a place that's safe. And there are sometimes, for certain kinds of intuition, the technique stops there. That's all you need. And if you want to go deeper and initiate some of the healing techniques and things like that, then you can establish that heart-brain coherence. Also, it has been found to be very effective. I just want to ask, I'm assuming you've had Joe Dispenza on your program. Have you had Joe on recently?
Yes, not recently. I haven't talked to him in a few years, but yes, he's been on as well.
Okay, well, one of the things, and the reason I asked, Dr. Joe Dispenza is a neuroscientist, talks about neuroplasticity and the way the brain can change. Another one of the new discoveries, Nicole, I mean, this stuff, it just goes on and on, because the science is moving so fast right now. But one of the discoveries is the existence of a brain state above the brain states that we've typically seen in our, you know, our high school and college biology books with the alpha and the beta states. Now we have a gamma state. And the gamma state is a very, very fast brainwave. It is associated with super learning. So, for example, and total recall. So if people have seen movies like, if you've ever seen Jason Bourne, you know, the Matt Damon and all of the Jason Bourne movies, where he does these amazing, he could walk into a room, he looks at the room once, he leaves, and he has total recall of everything in the room. Those techniques are actually being taught today, and they're using what we're talking about now, this heart-brain connection, for not only to take in tremendous amounts of information, but to be able to access, to recall the information that we have. Super learning is what it's called. So in a gamma state, that is achieved through this heart-brain connection. We are not only super learning, but it also helps people who are dealing with depression. It moves them out of the state of depression by being in the gamma state. So there are many benefits, health benefits, even if people aren't into what we would call the spiritual aspect, or they're not into the intuition or subconscious or any of those things. Simply harmonizing the heart and the brain is a really healthy thing to do. And it's something that can be done before we do the other things, the other practices that we have. So if we have a yoga practice, for example, yoga goes much better when our heart-brain is harmonized and in coherence. If we have a martial arts practice, we're much more effective when our heart and brain is in coherence. So what I like to say is everything goes better with coherence.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
So it's not in place of, we become coherent and then go about doing the practices that are important to us. And these techniques, Howard may have mentioned this, they're actually being used in the U.S. military, all four branches of the U.S. military, for our amazing men and women who are serving our country right now in ways that we just don't get to hear about. They're doing much more than working on the battlefield. So much is going on, rebuilding infrastructure and education and medical and all kinds of things. But before they're deployed, many of them are learning about heart-brain harmony so that they are focused when they're in their deployment. And the flip side that I think is really exciting is once your nervous system is wired for battlefield conditions or for survival, when you're deployed halfway around the world in Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere like that, it doesn't turn off the moment you get on the plane to come home. and the very sad statistics that that we're seeing about U.S. men and women, service men and women coming home, and high rates of suicide. It's very sad to talk about high rates of divorce, things like that, because they're having problems reintegrating. How do you make that shift from being in the battlefield to walking down the streets of, you know, San Francisco or Chicago or Albuquerque, New Mexico, or, you know, wherever? And these techniques are actually being used to help them reintegrate and reset. The term is to reset their nervous systems. Also being used by first responders, EMTs, police, fire, first responders right after 9/11, they started using the technique. So I'm just saying this so that our listeners can know this is more than simply a spiritual practice. It is the doorway to the spiritual practices that I've experienced personally through my indigenous experiences, or my experiences with indigenous people. But it is also, physiologically, it's a really healthy thing to do, and it opens the door to triggering healthy states within us. As I mentioned, over 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions, just from doing this one technique. That, again, was a long answer to a short question, but I just wanted people to know that the many applications for something like this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, intellectually it makes sense, and based on the conversations we've had over the decades of, you know, the connections with the heart and the power of that in bypassing the straight conscious mind, it all makes sense, right? So how do we apply this, or can we apply this, to manifesting a more positive outlook path for the collective in the world right now?
Well, this is it's a really good question, Nicole, and this is another facet of the studies that are being done, pioneered by the Institute of HeartMath. And as a former geologist, I'm not a practicing geologist now, but I am an earth scientist. So I find this, what I'm about to share, especially fascinating. We've all heard of the magnetic field of the earth, and the magnetic field, what a lot of people don't know, is that it influences every form of life. I mean, every blade of grass, every dog, every cat, every hamster, every goldfish, every CEO of every corporation, every leader of every nation, there is no them and us when it comes to the magnetic field of the earth. There is only a we. We are all deeply influenced by this field. And here's the reason that I'm saying this and why it's important, is because the science is showing very clearly that when the magnetic field of the earth is strong, it influences us in a positive way. We become less aggressive, more cooperative, more willing to work together, better listeners. And when the magnetic fields are weak, just the opposite happens. We become more aggressive, less willing to work together. And unfortunately, we discovered this through 9/11. 9/11 was the first time that scientists discovered how deep our relationship to the earth really goes. Now, maybe to our listeners, we say, you know, this is, you know, no big news to us. We've always known this. That's to the listeners of this program. But scientists have been trained to think of humans as separate from one another, separate from the earth. And they've been trained to believe that we have very little influence over our own bodies and over what happens in the world. And 9/11 taught scientists that that's not true, and here is what happened. The magnetic fields that I just described, they're so important that we have satellites every 30 minutes, or maybe even more frequently, but every 30 minutes they send data back to the Earth to tell scientists how strong those fields are and what's happening. They fluctuate on a daily basis. There are rhythms. They ebb and they flow. It looks like a big sine wave. Every 24 hours, the magnetic fields of the Earth ebb and they flow, and they ebb and they flow. Scientists knew that. But what happened was, there was one day when the magnetic data from the Earth, there was this huge spike. It was higher than what they would traditionally see. And they weren't used to seeing that. And they said, well, you know, what on Earth? I mean, literally, what on Earth is happening to make these magnetic fields so strong? And they looked at the date where that spike occurred, and it was 9 a.m., Eastern Standard Time, September 11th, 2001. It was 15 minutes after the first planes hit the first tower of the World Trade Center. So the scientists believe it took about 15 minutes for those horrific images that we all remember, those of us that were living then. They believe it took about 15 minutes for those images to circulate the globe and for people to respond emotionally to what they were seeing. And for most people, that response, it was a heart-based response. Now, they were different. Some of it was fear. Some of it was sadness. Some of it was shock. But everyone, it was a heart-based experience. The strongest magnetic field generated in the human body is generated by the human heart. And some people are surprised by that because they think it's the brain. The brain has a magnetic and electrical field, but it's weak compared to the human heart. The heart has the strongest electrical and the strongest magnetic field in the human body. So 9/11, what happened was hundreds of millions of people simultaneously were witnessing the horrors of New York City in 9/11, and hundreds of millions of hearts were generating increased magnetic response to what they were seeing that actually influenced the magnetic fields of planet Earth. And this is what was showing up on the satellite data. We spiked the magnetic field of our planet in response to what we saw, and here's why that's important. If you and your listeners can remember it, at least for a few days after 9/11, we were so close as a global family. I mean, not only in America, I was in Australia when the whole thing happened. I couldn't even come home for a few days. So I know that it wasn't only in America, but we were close as a family. People in big cities, they looked at each other in the eyes, and they spoke to one another, and there were hugs that were happening. And there was this sense of unity. And scientists attribute that to the high magnetic fields of the planet that resulted from our seeing what had happened. So the question became immediately, can we create that kind of an experience without the tragedy? Can we consciously raise that magnetic field of the planet without having a tragedy that we react to? Can we do it because we choose to? And the answer is yes. And this became the foundation of a project that is spearheaded by the Institute of Heart Math and for Transparency. I want our listeners to know I'm on the steering committee and a spokesperson for this project that is called the GCI, the Global Coherence Initiative. So the personal coherence we just talked about, personal coherence is good for us individually. Global coherence is good for the planet. And what has happened, I'll just make a long story very brief because I know we're coming up on the end of our hour here. Satellites to detect these fields are very expensive. So the scientists, the Institute of Heart Math, worked on ground-based sensors and created a network of these sensors in different nations that all feed back to one computer in Northern California, and they measure the planet's response. In our interaction with the planet, they measure these magnetic fields every day. And if people want to see these, you can actually see them real time. You can see them about, I think they post them usually at midnight after the data has been analyzed every day, at www.heartmath, H-E-A-R-T-M-A-T-H, all one word. .org, and then go to GCI, Global Coherence Initiative. It doesn't cost you anything. You can see the live data. You can see the science. You can read about the sensors. So we now have a feedback mechanism. So we can see what's happening with the fields of the Earth. That's part one. Part two is training people to create this heart-brain coherence so that throughout every day across this planet, there are people that are literally feeding the field in a positive way. So we're all feeding it every day. We're all having feelings. The question is, what are we feeding the field every day? And it's by learning these various techniques of heart-brain coherence that we're actually contributing not only to our own health, but contributing to the field that influences our cooperation or lack of cooperation on the planet. So it is there are two things happening here. We've got personal and we've got global healing that is occurring from embracing this relationship that was known by our ancestors in ancient traditions and is now being validated and reconfirmed and expanded through the best science of the modern world. And it all happens within the context of a world that we're living a time of extremes. The world is changing faster than we've been prepared to accept, and for many of us, we're just not used to that kind of change. So I think when I said I trust in the process, it's only now that the science is giving us the tools to tune our bodies and harmonize to the rate of change that we're seeing in the world while the demand for that change is emerging. And I think it's perfect symmetry, perfect timing. I don't understand everything that's happening. I don't claim to. but I do trust in the process and as I see it unfolding.
Wow, that's exciting. Global coherence sounds very intriguing. When next time we talk, we'll have to get more into that. I'm curious as if you know if there was any kind of major thing tracked on November 8th, 2016.
If there were any major, the signal broke up a little bit, and I couldn't hear what you said, Nicole.
Sorry, major energy shift tracked on November 8, 2016.
You know, it was interesting. I went back. It was not what people would have expected. I went back, and I looked at the magnetic fields. You're talking about the elections, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went back and I looked. Well, first I compared. I went back to Obama's first election, the very first time he was elected. And what the data showed is that there was a lot of excitement in the fields leading up to his inauguration. And on inauguration day, not so much the election, but on inauguration day, the field became very quiet. It was the global energetic field became very quiet. Scientists are reluctant to say one thing causes another. So what they will say is that something correlates with another. And there's a high correlation between a calm that came, that flowed across the planet, at least in those magnetic fields, and when the inauguration happened, and it lasted for a few days. We didn't see that kind of change, but we also didn't see a lot of, you know, they thought their scientists and many casual observers thought there might be some kind of, you know, anxiety showing up in the field. And that didn't really show up either, at least initially. It showed up a few days, I think it was 3 or 4 days later, there started to be a lot of activity in the field. And if you go and on this website, the bright areas that you see on those 24-hour charts, that is where there's a high level of activity. And when you see the dark blues and we don't see much happening there, that is those are the quieter areas. So there was I think people were surprised at what happened during the election and the inauguration. And I think maybe the field, this is my personal opinion, this isn't HeartMath saying this, my personal feeling is I think people, the world was surprised and was kind of, I think the magnetic fields are reflecting us kind of letting it sink in what has just happened. And it took a few days to do that. And then about 3 days later, we started seeing a lot of, really a lot of activity. And that's, I think, when people figured out what just happened and they said, okay, you know, now what? What's next?
So, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, that's a very intriguing project. Wow. I was not aware of that, and now I'm on the live data, so I'm going to be on there for several hours. That's fun. Thanks for letting us know about it.
You were able to bring up the site while we're talking?
Yes. I went into Global Coherence under Research and then Live Data. So
you can see the live data. What's important here is this project, and I tell you, everyone is fascinated by this, U.S. military, mainstream scientists. We have never had this depth of understanding between the human body and the magnetic fields of the Earth as individuals and the collective response and our collective relationship to this field. And it harkens back to this idea that we are part of the world rather than separate from. We are part of a living system, and we influence this system consciously or subconsciously, whether we know it or not. We're influencing it. And now we have the ability to consciously come together as a global community. And through doing something that's good for us individually, collectively, it's good for our communities and it's good for nations. And I can't think of a better time to have that ability and to breathe life into that ability. And maybe not a better way to end our program, because it looks like it's almost the top of the hour for you. So
we are there indeed. I really appreciate you, your work, your long years of dedication to bringing this information forward, and I hope you'll join me when your next book comes out by October to discuss that as well.
I would love to. All I need is an invitation, so I think I just heard one.
You did.
Yeah, Nicole, thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, and everyone listening, I just want to thank you all for all you're doing just to be the best person you can be and to create the best world possible. I'm an optimist. I've never been more optimistic about our world, and I'm also a realist. We have a lot of work to do to bring what we know in our hearts to fruition in our lives. And I just want to say one thing about work. The prophet Khalil Gibran, the poet and the prophet and the author in the 20th century, in his book that was titled The Prophet, he wrote about work. And what he said very clearly, and I read this when I was 10 years old, and it's been with me ever since, he said, work is our love made visible. Work is love made visible. And it's going to take a lot of work to change the way we think and live. That's our love made visible. And I think we're worth it, and I think our world is worth it. So that's what I'd like to leave our listeners with today, Nicole.
Perfect. Resilience from the Heart, Greg Braden's latest book. We'll talk to him again soon. And Greg, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. I look forward to the next time. Take care.
I'm looking forward to it already. Greg Braden can be found online and linked up at newsforthesoul.com. This will be in the archives and re-aired on our California stations this week, and we'll go out from there. We are back with more right after this.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights. Life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
And we love News for the Soul!
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show. Just enormous, enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing... amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing. Like this is what's getting. It's some angel telling somebody, hey, listen, get on this show, listen to this program, even not my program, whatever program you've got on. It's really amazing.
It's hard to believe it's 17 years since there in Vancouver. And you were sitting there in class, and you were using remote viewing, and I think I said to you that you were going to be a radio talk show host or something along those lines. It wasn't really a prediction. It was just a kind of a sense of who you were and what you were doing and the direction you were going, and wow, voila, and there you were.
And still going.
But it's amazing. Look at what you've done with it. I just wanted to say I'm very proud of you. For what you've accomplished, for just the format, to the assemblage of wonderful people, great minds, and people who are working to serve humanity and do the things that they do. I've been looking through your list of callers and interviewees, and you just do a tremendous job. I'm so proud of you. I really am. And I'm proud of all the people that support you and follow you and do what they do, and just keep doing that for this wonderful woman. It's so important because there are not a lot of really high-quality message portals that are out there where messengers get to come in and say what they want to say in this format. So it's because of your support of her that she's able to continue doing that. So please step that up and continue doing it. And I just want to do it more. I mean, I feel good being here and being with you. I always do when I'm talking with you. So I think we just need to keep doing this more.
And we love News for the Soul!
Hello, everybody. This is Damian Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Enfoldment. This is News for the Soul.
Hello, this is Satyan Raja, and you're listening to News for the Soul. Be open in your mind, your body, your being. Allow yourself to drench in this awesome information to evolve you to your next place.
Hey, this is Dave Morehouse, and you're listening to News for the Soul.
Yeah, man. We all love to hear the good news, so we all should rush to hear the good news. Right. But we have to find the good news.
NSPN, NSPN, News for the Soul at the very best. NSPN, NSPN, News for the Soul at the very best. NSPN, NSPN, News for the Soul at the very best.
Yeah, man, just log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Can you miss?
We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We not go put none of the negative in there. We not go put none of the negative in there. NFTN, NFTN, News for the Soul at the very best. NFTN, NFTN, News for the Soul at the very best.
Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time, come hear the good news, share the good news. And we all feeling good. good news.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Memories from Heaven, that's what we're going to be talking about today. Dr. Wayne Dyer's last book, co-authored with Dee Garns. And the day that Dr. Wayne Dyer passed, we were actually in communication with Hay House and trying to book the interview about the book. That obviously got put on hold. Everybody was in shock by his passing, and it was a process kind of picking up the conversation. So, you know, divine intervention happened a couple of times, and this is when we're supposed to be having the conversation. My guest this hour, Dee Garns, co-author of Memories from Heaven, Children's Astounding Recollections of the Time Before They Came to Earth. And again, this is co-authored by the two of them. We've got Dee for the next while here live on News for the Soul. Dee, welcome to News for the Soul.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's interesting. I've been so excited about talking to you about this book, and we've had a couple of rescheduling, so today must be planetary alignment and all kinds of epic things going on. Today is the conversation. So I'm excited. I want to start by asking, how did you first connect with Dr. Dyer?
Well, we have been next door neighbors for a few years, so that's how we met. And I have been a massage therapist now for about 16 years. And so he started coming to me for massages regularly. And then with that, we started to get to know each other, and we ended up becoming great friends. And then I just kind of morphed into being his personal assistant. And so we worked very closely the past 4 or 5 years. And then this book came about, and we did this book together.
How did this book come about?
Yes. So this book came about. I had, at the time, my son Marcus was 17 months old, and he was just wanted to speak and talk so bad. And Wayne said, Dee, this is the time. You need to ask him where he's from before he was here and ask him what God is like. And he would pick him up and look at him in his eyes and say, okay, you tell me about God. I know you know. You tell me. And it was fun. And, this one particular evening, my son Marcus and I were eating dinner, and my husband was there. And I was just looking at him with awe because he's just so beautiful. And I was pregnant with my little girl at the time, Shiloh. And so I was looking at my son and feeling my belly, and I was thinking to myself, okay, somehow I've made these bodies somehow in my, but where did his consciousness come from? Like, where did he come from? And it was just one of those moments of just, you know, when you just stop and think about everything, and it's just mind blowing. And so I just blurted out, and I wasn't expecting an answer. I blurted out, where did you come from? And he drops his fork and puts both of his arms up to the sky and looks up. And we were both just taken aback. And so then it prompted the next question, what is God like? And this, my son, my beautiful boy, had not spoken any words yet. He looks right at me and he says, light. And it was just, it was perfect and beautiful. And I wrote it down and I shared it with Wayne the next day. And he shared that story on his Facebook page, and he invited parents or people who are around children to ask their children questions, where they were from or what God is like, the response that we got back was insane. I mean, people from over the globe, thousands and thousands and thousands of stories just poured in, and we would get together and just scroll down and just read all these stories. And so then from there, we decided we've got to share this with the world. I mean, this is just, it's amazing.